Alrighty. Got to hold that there. Alright, so everybody has a donut. Everybody has a handout.
There are donuts back there, so make sure you get one.
Yeah.
Take them home.
Well, donuts look good. Let's see. Don't really need a pen today, but you might want one. All right, today, yeah, I've been looking forward to today. I wish the weather was a little better, because I think all of us would kind of benefit from what we're going to talk about today. All right, so as you know, we started going through the Old Testament. It's been a year and a few months ago now, and we finished Malachi a few weeks ago, almost a month ago now. And we're getting ready to start the New Testament. And that period between Malachi and Matthew is a lot of stuff happens. And a lot of stuff happens that kind of that Jesus has to deal with and teach against. The disciples are part of it. There's just a lot of stuff has changed. So today we're just going to talk about what happened during those 400 years.
Awesome.
Yeah, because you don't really hear this a lot, like from the pulpit, because it's not really, it's in the Bible. I'm going to show it to you where it's at in the Bible, but it's not big and popular. So, on your handout, first thing, the New Testament period, the 400, we call them the silent years. Does anyone know why we call them the silent years?
No prophets.
Because of, yeah.
There's no prophets. God is silent. You know, he talks to Malachi, and then John the Baptist shows up. And what I drew here, this is kind of a more formal drawing of what I had done a few weeks ago. On your handout,
awesome.
You see the little engine that could. That's Israel. They're just a humble little train doing God's work. And they go into the silent years, this tunnel called the silent years, where we don't see anything of them in the Bible. And when they come out in Matthew, they're this big locomotive, this big bloated religious system in Matthew. So what happened in that tunnel is what we're going to talk about today. And that paragraph I put, in short, it's the Greekification of Israel is what happened. If you look at that table there, the nation of Israel before the 400 years, in the book of Malachi, they were governed by Persia. I got some new maps for the New Testament here. This is the closest map I could find to kind of show what we're talking about here. This is Israel here. This little dot's Jerusalem. So we're all kind of familiar with this, 12 tribes and yeah. All that. Babylon is over here. My dot here is Susa, where Daniel was at.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah. So remember, Babylon took the guys from the south, the Assyrians, they end up becoming the Persian Empire.
How many miles is it between dot and dot?
It's about 1,000 miles. It's a 4-month journey because they followed the rivers, and that's where they were captive for those 70 years that we've talked about many times. So basically at the end of Malachi, the Jews are doing their thing in Jerusalem. The Persians are in control over here. And that's when Malachi ends. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. So when it ends there on the table, I put they were governed by Persia. Remember Cyrus back in Nehemiah told them that they could go back and rebuild the city and the temple. So Nehemiah, Ezra, Haggai, all those last Old Testament books, they went back to Jerusalem and rebuilt. Cyrus was in control. Israel was ruled by Persia. Cyrus was the king of Persia. All right, so the next thing they had on your table there, they spoke Hebrew. Before, during the book of Malachi, they spoke Hebrew. The Old Testament was written in Hebrew.
Greek.
Well, not yet. They had the 39 books of the Old Testament. You know, when Malachi puts his pen down, they've got 39 books that are Old Testament. And they had, in that table there, they had the priests, the Levites, and the scribes. You know, we know who those guys are. The priests, ministered in the temple. And that's part of the Levitical thing from Moses. That was all scriptural. Scribes, Ezra was a scribe. Those guys are the ones that kept the basically the Old Testament books in order, and the Levites, you know, the priests and stuff. But afterwards, now look at that column on the right side of your on the first page. After the 400 years, now they're governed by Rome. You know what happened? Now they're governed by. Now they speak Greek. They dress Greek. They have Greek names. And now, on top of the 39 books of the Old Testament, they've got this thing called the Midrash, the Mishnah, the Talmud, and the apocryphal books show up. The books of the Apocrypha. And these are the books that our Jewish friends still use today. These books come about and really were kind of solidified during these 400 silent years for the books that Jesus had to teach against.
And you got those written down?
Yeah, we're going to go through exactly what they are. And on top of the priests and Levites and the scribes in Malachi, now all of a sudden they've got rabbis. They've got these zealots. They've got Sadducees and Pharisees. You know, we recognize all these groups from the New Testament. Yeah.
Those just different. I mean, like say in the military, is that what they're just rankings of the priests?
No, they're actually pretty different. They believe some pretty wild things.
So each one believes in something different.
Right. Yes. Yeah. You want to just skip there? Because they have the rabbi zealots, the Essenes, the Sanhedrin. They had a big part in killing Jesus. Mm-hmm. And the synagogues. See, why do they have synagogues now? They didn't have them in the Old Testament. So now they have synagogues all over the place. Now, for an explanation of those groups, let's go ahead and just skip forward because it is interesting. It's back on page... it starts on page 4. So, rabbis... And I got most of this information because I read a lot of Jewish stuff. I've told you guys that, and I read the Mishnah and the Talmud and the Midrash. They're very interesting reads. And that's where I pulled this stuff from to get a exact definition. The rabbis are just the wise leaders, teachers of the Bible, of the Old Testament. They're the teachers. Now the zealots. The zealots were a political group that fought hard. Okay, actually, did you guys ever see Red Dawn?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
The original with Patrick Swayze,
yep.
The real one. Remember the Wolverines hiding out in the mountains that were opposing the Russians and all that? That would be like the Zealots. Those guys strongly opposed the Greek and Roman influence that was pouring into Israel. They strongly opposed it. So, and they opposed it so much that they assassinated leaders that were cooperating with the Romans and the Greeks. Simon was a zealot, ends up being one of the 12 disciples. It's the Mishnah says that Barabbas was a zealot, that he was a murderer, part of the zealots' party. So,
was also Boaz?
No, that'd been way back when. But
yeah, that's right.
Yeah, not him. All right, so that's the zealots. They played a key part in the destruction of the second temple. But we'll kind of get to some of that. But all right, now the Sadducees. It's the next one on page 5. They were basically priests. Israel had no king. They were now under Persian rule. So the high priests kind of elevated themselves to be the spokesmen, the leaders for Israel. So they got pretty big-headed. They became the leaders that worked closely with Rome and Greece. They were hated by the Jews because they worked closely, and they would appoint them positions in government. So the Sadducees are not liked by any other group.
Sadducees.
Yeah. It's hard to explain this without kind of hopping around, but one of the key things with the Sadducees, actually, I'm kind of getting jumbled out, but the books that they end up with, the Midrash and the Mishnah, after Malachi, The Jews teach that when God gave Moses the written laws, the Ten Commandments, and all that that they carried forward, that God also gave Moses a bunch of verbal laws, a bunch of verbal things that never were written down until the Malachi-ish time. They actually started in Babylon, but the Sadducees reject that, where the Pharisees loved that. The Pharisees take the oral law above the written words that Moses did. That's why when Jesus would talk to these guys, like the Pharisees would ask him and try to trip him up on the resurrection and different things that are like really in the oral law. And the Sadducees didn't buy the oral law. So it's kind of there when does that. The Sadducees only believed in the first five books of Moses. They didn't believe all the rest of that stuff about, you know, Isaiah and all the prophets. So they were like stuck in the old school.
It's called the Torah.
Torah. Yeah, the Tanakh, the whole thing. But where the Pharisees believed the oral law more than the written law. So they were just all messed up. And that's why the two groups are very different. And they're basically priests that have, there's a schism, or they've kind of separated on what they believe. You know, Nicodemus was a Pharisee. Paul was a Pharisee. Looking for some other thing to find out here. The Sadducees, like I said, they worked with the group, the Romans and the Greeks, where the Pharisees did not. So that was another big difference in them. Everyone hated the Sadducees because they were working with the enemy. Now the last one down there, the Essenes. These are interesting. This is an interesting group. They got really big before John the Baptist. Some of the Jewish writings say John the Baptist was a former Essene. These guys were the Amish of their time. They opposed the Greeks and the Romans and anything that wasn't Jewish. And they really separated themselves and gave themselves to poverty, over to poverty. They like left town. They live out south of Jerusalem. They don't want anything to do with the temple. They don't want anything to do with the organized religion of the Jews. And they start adopting a lot of the mystical teachings out of the Orient, and they were actually the founding of the Kabbalah movement that's still popular today. A lot of the movie stars are into Kabbalah because it's kind of a hodgepodge of mysticism, a little bit of Old Testament sprinkled in. I know Madonna, she's always big into Kabbalah. That came out of the Essenes. Now, one thing the Essenes did do, this Amish group, whenever they left Jerusalem, they took with them a lot of writings and things, and they built themselves a little library south of Jerusalem, and they put a bunch of these writings in these clay pots.
Oh, yeah. Dead Sea Scrolls.
That end up being the Dead Sea Scrolls. So that's where that stuff comes from, is the Essenes separating and hiding out in those caves. And that's why they found not just the Old Testament, they found all kinds of goofy writings from all the other things that they believe. So that's kind of where they come in. So, interesting.
Not in the Bible, is it?
The scene is not in the Bible, specifically.
It's kind of weird that I brought that Bible in today when we're going over this.
Yeah, the Masonic. Where is that dude?
I left it with Brian.
All right, then the Sanhedrin. This was another thing that they came up with. It's basically a court. It's a little court system the Jews came up with. Because, like I said, they don't have a king anymore since they've went into captivity back before Babylon, when they went to Babylonian captivity. They lost their king, so now they're in Israel with no king. They're under Greek and Roman rule. So the Jews developed their own little religious court system to deal with the religious matters, and that's what the Sanhedrin is. Now, what's interesting with the Sanhedrin, I actually put it on our timeline, which we'll look at in a second, but I thought I'd put it on here. Oh, it's on the next chart. It's in my Matthew chart. around 5 or 6 A.D., the Romans got tired of the Sanhedrin, and they had a little skiff, but the Romans revoked the right of the Sanhedrin to pronounce anybody to death for, you know, adultery and all the other things that in the law of Moses were worthy of death, the Sanhedrin would carry out. Well, the Romans revoked that right around 5 or 6, 7 AD. That's why when they wanted to kill Jesus so bad, they had to get Rome to do it, because they had no more rights to do that. So we'll talk about that a little bit next week. So that's kind of who those groups were back on the first page. That now all of a sudden they have all these groups. And it's really because of the what would you call it, occupation or the control of the Greeks and the Romans and the way the different Jews dealt with that. Some liked it, some didn't, this and that. So, all right, let's look at the next page. Page 2. This is where it's pretty cool. And the silent years...
Page 2.
The key to the silent years is really kind of in the book of Daniel. I mentioned it when we did Daniel. I did this handout, this little picture here on page 2. Yeah. I just did a snapshot of the handout I did back in Daniel. And at the time I did Daniel, I remember saying I really can't go through all of these because it's pretty big. I mean, it's even much bigger than just today. But Jeff Trudge, you know, he's doing a whole Wednesday series on Daniel. But there's some key things in Daniel. Here's the way Daniel lays out, just high level. He starts out in chapter 2 with a vision. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar had the dream. This is what he dreamed. Well, then later on through the book of Daniel, he has more visions where he gets specifics about this. And that's kind of what I showed here on this four thing here. That's the big picture. Chapter 7 is more about individual countries, because all these represent kingdoms. And then chapter 8 really hones in on Greece, is what we're going to talk about today. And then chapter 9 is the 70 weeks, which is kind of the time and timeline of that, this happening. And all right.
That is what?
Well, let's look at it. Let's go to Daniel 2. Let's just dive into Daniel 2 here. Daniel chapter 2, and we're going to start around verse 31. Any questions so far? It's kind of high level, but all right. So let's look at Daniel chapter 2, and remember what happens is, you know, Daniel was he got taken captive. He's over here in Shushan, and Nebuchadnezzar, the bad king, has a dream that really bothers him. He doesn't understand what it means. Well, who can interpret this dream? Mm-hmm. Well, of course, Daniel can. Does anyone remember what Daniel is a type of?
Jesus.
That's close. He's a type of the Holy Spirit because he's an interpreter of dreams. He's an interpreter. So all through Daniel, whenever Nebuchadnezzar has these weird dreams, Daniel can tell him what they mean. So let's look at Daniel chapter 2. And this is where Daniel's telling him what this image means. Because Nebuchadnezzar dreamed about this image. Verse 31, chapter 2. Thou, O king, sawest, and behold, you saw a great image. This great image, whose brightness was exceeding, it was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. The image's head was of fine gold, up here, and his breast was of silver, and his belly and his thighs were of brass, and his legs are of the iron, mixed with clay. And then you've seen a stone that came down and basically busted the image up. And that stone is the Lord Jesus. When he comes, he's going to bust this image. So the interpretation is where it gets cool. And that starts in verse 37 of chapter 2. This is what he's describing. Thou, O king, king of kings, God in heaven, have given thee a kingdom. He's kind of schmoozing up to him here. Verse 38, and wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, everybody loves you. All right, last sentence. Thou art this head of gold. So Nebuchadnezzar is the head of gold.
He's Babylon.
He's Babylon. He is head of Babylon. He is the man in Babylon. So you can actually write in your Bible, the head of gold equals Nebuchadnezzar. All right, verse 39. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, which is the next one. He doesn't tell us what that is yet. And then the third kingdom is inferior. It's of brass. And it'll rule over the whole earth. And this is Greece. And we'll get to that in a second. The third kingdom is the empire of Alexander the Great. That was one of the biggest world empires. All right, verse 40. The fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, and which is, ends up being Rome. So that's what the dream means. It means it's kingdoms, and it's in order that they're going to take place. And it's going to end with Rome. And there's going to be two types of Rome. There's going to be a political and a religious form of Rome. Because this, the legs break out around 500 AD. So that's a whole other thing. All right, so that's so their kingdom. So now let's flip over to Daniel 8. And Daniel 8 is where he's going to kind of hone in a little more on the Greece part. And this is really cool. And this is where I got to use my drawing. We'll go to that in a second. This is Daniel 8. And I'm a terrible drawer, but I want to just kind of represent a little bit. All right, so Daniel 8. And remember, Daniel's telling what's going to happen. This is going to be the third kingdom, which is the kingdom during these intertestament period. All right. Okay. All right, so verse 1. In the third year, the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared, Daniel, and he saw in the vision. He was in Shushan. Verse 3. I lifted up my eyes, and I saw, and behold, there stood before a river a ram. Right there.
That was before the Jordan?
No, it's kind of, it's the whole Mideast section. But this is the Tigris and Euphrates. All right, so I seen a ram, and he's got two horns.
Oh.
All right, so we're going to say, now, the interpretation of that ram, if we want to, just let me just skip ahead to verse 20. Just look at chapter 8, verse 20. Chapter 8, verse 20 says, the ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. So we don't have to guess who this ram is. It's the kingdom of Media Persia.
That's good.
Yeah. All right, so now look at verse 4. And I saw the ram pushing westward, which is exactly what Persia did. Persia started over here, and it slowly pushed westward. Conquered all of Israel. This is the time of Malachi, you know, all the prophets that we've read, Nehemiah, all these guys. Persia owns this, and they're pushing this way. Persia pushed all the way to Greece. You guys seen the movie 300?
No.
Gerard Butler, six pack. That was this going on right here. That was the ram and the goat going at it, because 300 happened up around here. But Persia made their way all the way to up into Asia Minor. So.
Wow.
All right, so that's verse 4. He said, I saw a ram pushing westward, northward, southward. Neither was there any, no one could deliver anyone out of his hand. He did according to his will and became great. Persia's great. All right, verse 5. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat. So here's our next guy, the he-goat. If we want to define him, look over at verse 21 of chapter 8. Daniel 8:21 says, the rough goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn that's between his eyes is the first king, which we're going to talk about in a second. This is Alexander the Great. This is Greece. So Media Persia is going to go up against Greece. All right, so look at verse. Okay, let's go back to verse 5. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west, which is where Greece is at. Greece is over here. He's coming west. On the face of the whole earth, and he touched not the ground. It's a reference to how quick he's rolling. Like when a horse is just flying, man, his feet aren't even touching the ground. Alexander the Great started up here in Macedonia and had conquered this entire board within just a few years. I mean, it's just phenomenal what he did. He was a great strategician, military dude. So that's kind of referencing how quick this is going to happen. His feet touched not the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Which that horn is Alexander. And whenever they came together, the two horns, standing before the river, they ran into him, the fury of his power. Verse 7, they do battle. They smote the ram. The goat wins. They broke his horns, the two horns of Media Persia. There was no power in the ram to stand before him. He cast him down to the ground, stomped him. So the goat stomps the ram in verse 7. All right. Verse 8 is where it starts getting cranking up some more. Therefore, the he-goat, he waxed very great. And when he was strong and great, when he was strong, the great horn was broken.
Does wax mean one?
He grew. He was growing. He was waxing. Like today we say the waxing moon and the waning moon. It's a word. It's kind of an old English word meaning you're increasing. Mm. But so the horn, Alexander, beep, he gets broken. Which Alexander died very, very young. He was only like 30 years old. He started this little thing in his 20s, and he died when he was 30. I don't even know if he was 30. Yeah, probably was stressed. It's like it says, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones. Mm. All right, so this is cool. I love history. And like I said, Daniel, I had said this when we did Daniel. Daniel gives us the history of the nations before it happens. So the horn breaks, and now he's got four horns. What happened was, and this is a historical fact, when Alexander died young, his empire was divided up into his four generals. And there's four of these guys. There's like Lychicus, the Ptolemies, Cleopatra, were down here in this part of the kingdom. The Seleucids end up taking all of Syria. And we'll get to more of that in a second. But anyway, his kingdom gets divided up into four. That's the four horns. Hmm. All right. Now look at verse 9. And out of one of the horns came forth a little horn. So now we got another different color. Out of the four horns is going to come another horn that we need to be concerned with in verse 9. A little horn which waxed exceeding great toward the south and toward the east. And in verse 10, it waxed great even to the host of heaven. Verse 11, he magnifies himself even to the prince of the host. And by him, the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down.
Nebuchadnezzar?
Nope. It's close. And it goes on to talk about how wicked this guy is and that he persecutes God's people. The little horn is a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes. Hmm. You know, there's a bunch of kings in our Old Testament that, you know, we're familiar with. We all know about Pharaoh and Egypt and Nebuchadnezzar and Cyrus. Antiochus, or Antiochus, I've heard both ways, is a very bad dude. But he's not actually in the Bible by name. He's just talked about here. This little horn that came out of the Seleucids, because the four horns were the four empires. The Seleucids had Syria. And the Antiochus family ruling came out of this general, one of the horns.
Antiochus
Epiphanes is and I don't want to get ahead, but
is that where the word epiphany came from?
He named himself. A lot of these guys name themselves with these big grand names. So he's like Antiochus Epiphanes. You know, he's all that. He's kind of what he's saying. He's an epiphany. Okay, so Antiochus comes in this chapter. He persecutes his people. He persecutes God's people, and that persecution. And we'll talk a little bit more about it, is what starts the Maccabean Revolt.
Hmm.
And that's where, and they're actually, it's actually shown in verse 11, or chapter 11. Yeah, okay, 11:30. All right, so if you go to Daniel 11:30, basically chapter 11, okay, let me say this too. Remember in the Old Testament, you know, we've done all these prophecies. All of these prophecies have like double meanings. They have, remember I doing that one time I drew the chameleon, I had the two eyes. When these prophecies come out, one eye is looking forward to, in this case, the Antichrist. Another eye is looking locally to this Antiochus guy. So this Antiochus is kind of a type of Christ. So
the type of Antichrist.
Man, thanks. Yeah. They're both persecuting God's people. But Antiochus, you know, was happened during the 400 years. All right, so, and what happens is, I don't have time to get into it, but it's really interesting. These guys, Antiochus is always battling, you know, headquarters and this and that, and the Ptolemies run this area down here with Cleopatra and all her crew, and Antiochus, they're all the time battling each other. Well, one of the times that they battle each other, Antiochus gets sent home with his tail between his legs, and he's mad at the world, and he takes it out on the Jews. You know, it's like when we come home from work and you kick the dog, because that's what Antiochus does here in chapter 11. So, in verse 30, chapter 11, 30, the ships of Chittim, the Chittim's Rome, it's like an old, old saying of Rome. Well, that's Chittim. That's H. All right, for the ships of Chittim shall come against him. Rome came up against him. They were grieved. He went back home. Let me read verse 30. For the ships of Chittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return, and have indignation against the holy covenant. So shall he do. He shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant. And verse 31 and 32, he just keeps getting mad. Verse 33. And they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet shall they fall by the sword, and by the flame, by captivity, and by the spoil many days. Actually, verse 32 I should have looked at. I'm sorry. And as such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. In verse 32, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. That's the Maccabeans that go up against Antiochus. There. Okay, so yeah, we're going to talk about the timeline because I've kind of gotten jumbled here. So here's what happened. I think we're going to be done with Daniel for now. Because Daniel talks about things hundreds of years before it happens. And what I did here in your handouts, you know, I told you last week we're starting a timeline. You know, this was the Old Testament timeline. Ended with Malachi. Now, the timeline you have today is this 400 silent years. This is what went on. So, shortly after Malachi, on your timeline, there's this King Philip of Macedonia. He dies. And Macedonia's up here. And he's got a son named Alexander. He gives the throne to. So Alexander, as a young 20-year-old dude, takes off conquering the known world. And he actually makes it to Jerusalem around 332. And that's the next bullet. And the priests all show him Daniel 8. And he thinks it's pretty cool. So it's cool to think about Alexander seeing what we just read and knowing that he's the he-goat. And knowing that after him is going to be four generals, which may be why he wrote it in his will. I don't know. But because of that, he didn't destroy Jerusalem like he does all the other cities. So he left Jerusalem intact. Well, he goes on. Alexander makes his way. He actually goes all the way to India. He defeats this whole area here. And there's all kinds of cool stories about his battles. He ends up dying in Babylon when he's a young guy. We don't know if he got poisoned. There's all kinds of conjecture. He got killed, poisoned. He was a homosexual, had a lot of lovers, and there's speculation some of them offed him. It's hard to say. All right, Antiochus, there he comes into play in 175 on your timeline. Something really big happens with Antiochus, actually. I probably ought to bring up. up until this point, the Jews had their priests, you know, and it was all Levitical and it was all scriptural. Antiochus hated the Jews, so there's this guy that went to Antiochus, a guy named Melanus. He bought the priesthood from Antiochus. Antiochus gave it to him. That kind of ended the Levitical priesthood as we know it through the Old Testament. So Antiochus and this Melanus dude, they start this severe persecution on the Jews. And it's said that Antiochus had this little portable altar that he'd haul around Israel, and he would make the Jews sacrifice pigs on this little altar.
Pigs.
Yeah, pigs. It was a hated animal, unclean. You know, it was just terrible. He forbid the circumcisions. He tried to get them all speaking Greece. He did all kinds of things to try to Greekify Israel. Well, Antiochus' little rolling altar made it to this city called Midden. I believe it's Midden. All right, and there's an old school guy named Matthias, and he said he ain't having any part of this pig thing. So he went Jason Statham on the whole crew, or the whole rolling altar crew, and killed every one of them. Well, of course, Antiochus ain't going to put up with that, so then they start fighting back. That guy, Matthias, that went Jason Statham, he is the father of the Maccabees. He had a son named Judah Maccabee. And that's where the Maccabees come from. The Maccabees came, they resisted the Greekification that Antiochus was trying to bring on them by sacrificing the pig. Now, Antiochus ends up, and he does go to the temple in Jerusalem and sacrifice a pig in the altar in Jerusalem. Well, what happens is the Maccabees, remember they were the Wolverines in Red Dawn, they flee to the mountains around Jerusalem, and they're doing all these guerrilla battles with Antiochus's people, and it goes on for about 3 years. Finally, the Maccabees push Antiochus's armies out. And the Maccabees, the Jews, take control of the temple again. And they go through an 8-day ceremony of cleaning the temple. That's what Hanukkah is. The Jews celebrate that cleansing of the temple, the defiling by Antiochus, with Hanukkah. It has nothing to do with Christmas.
Every day.
Well, the reason it's a special thing is because when they started cleaning the temple up and getting the pig stuff out of the temple, they only had a little bit of oil for their candles. So they just went ahead and lit it, knowing that that's not enough. Well, miraculously, the oil lasted 8 days, enough to clean the whole temple.
Huh.
So it's like, wow, this is cool. So they started a feast of dedication, which is actually in the New Testament. One of the times Jesus goes to Jerusalem is during the feast of dedication, which is Hanukkah today. So that's why they have Hanukkah. It's in December, nothing to do with Christmas, but it's celebrating the Maccabees taking back the temple and regaining control. So that's kind of that.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. That's through here. Now, like all good things, the Maccabees, they start going downhill, you know, as they get new leaders. They kind of fall out of favor and they end up doing bad things, kind of like bald knobbers or something. But one thing that's interesting, whenever they start going bad, the Maccabees go down into Edom and they make everybody convert to Judaism at knife point. So now the Edomites say they're Jewish too, which comes into play a little later on when the Herod clan comes around. But so the Maccabees end up being bad, and after a while the Maccabees are doing their thing, Greece has a little neighbor over here called Rome, and they're growing in power. So by the time the Maccabees have like fizzled out, Rome has come into play, and Rome actually takes Jerusalem around 60-63 AD, and that's here on your chart. When Rome comes into power, they pretty much sell, you know, who wants to be in charge of this area? They sell that, and they sold it to the family of the Herods, which are Edomites.
Yeah. Herod.
The Herods. That's where they came from. And even to legitimize it, Herod marries one of the Maccabean girls, and he's part of the family now, and they put him in charge. And so he rules there. I did stick Mark Anthony on here. It's so cool how this stuff intertwines. You know, we all have heard of Cleopatra, Mark Anthony.
Oh, yeah.
Mark Anthony ends up being over Rome, or in this area somewhat. But Mark Anthony has a beef with some of the old Persians over here called Parthians. And Mark Anthony is always going over here trying to defeat them, and they always defeat him. Well, then the Parthians will come back and have a fight with Rome. Or not Rome, but Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is afraid of the Parthians, is what I'm saying, because it's like a hornet's nest. Mark Anthony keeps going over there stirring them up. The Parthians have a very popular group called the Magi in them. Because, remember Daniel, back in Daniel 5, Daniel was appointed the king of the Magi. Mm-hmm. They were all the guys that knew their word. They knew the Bible. They probably knew a lot of other things. The Magi knew, and they also knew about the 70 weeks of Daniel that gives a timeline of when Jesus was going to be around. So when Jesus shows up in Matthew, and then the Magi show up from Parthia, that's why they're so afraid, because these guys are all the time coming over here whipping us, because Mark Anthony's always bothering them. Well, now here they are at our door asking about a king of the Jews.
Yeah.
That's why Herod was afraid.
Now he's like, I am the king of the Jews.
Yeah, they're right, I'm the king. Well, let me see this guy. So
it says that he was agitated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's why I stuck him, because one of Mark Anthony's big sieges of Parthia was in 43. And then Parthia comes back and just whips Jerusalem again. Actually, the Parthians give him such a beef that Herod has to leave Jerusalem and go back to Daddy in Rome for protection. And then after a period of time, Herod goes back. And this is only like 20 years before Jesus. So whenever these guys show up again, he was afraid. And I think Doug Howey did a pretty good job talking about some of that a few weeks ago. All right, so in 63, Rome takes over the area. You know, we just talked about the Mark Anthony and them. And then Rome pretty much had the area until the Turks up in the 500s. But you can see on here, John the Baptist starts at the end of your timeline here. And next week we'll pick up with John the Baptist. Now, what I did want to spend a few minutes on is the next page on your handout, the life under Greek rule. Greeks were the cool kids in the area. Everybody wanted to be like the Greeks. They were the thinkers. They had all the cool, you know, they had Aristotle, they had Plato, Socrates, all the cool deep thinkers come out of Greece. So this is what the Jews, after in this 400 silent years, this is what they had to go up against after Alexander took them. Point one, you guys have probably heard of Hellenism. Hellenism simply means Greek, one who speaks Greek. And that's why it said that the nation of Israel was Hellenized after Alexander the Great took them. All that Greek influence came in like a wildfire. All the cool kids were in town. They had things like the Olympics, which were awesome. All the Jews wanted to be part of the Olympics. Their money was different. They spoke different. They dressed different. They changed the temple signs to Greek. Everything went Greek. Even in the New Testament, all the apostles, the disciples, those are all Greek names. You know, they really adopted Greece, the Greek culture. I listed a few of the big Greek folks, the Epicureans under point four, the Stoics, the Plato, and kind of what they believed. All that influence came into Israel. Put the Edomites in there. Now, point seven, there on page three, point seven, the old school Jews, the Pharisees, they didn't like the Greek culture, whereas the Sadducees did. That's kind of caused some of the beef between those groups. Life was generally good under Greek control until that little horn of Antiochus Epiphanes took over. And he's the one that tried to forcibly assimilate. Now then point 10, the Greeks finally did fall in 146. Now, in 146 is when Rome, basically when Rome comes in. Now, on the next page, I've got the Roman culture. Rome, since they were up here by Greece, they had also been Hellenized at an early stage in their empire. So when Rome came in, it was still Greece. I mean, they added some Latin, but Rome, everybody wanted to be like Greece. So the Rome influence was still Greek. Rome and Greece fought for many years, under four there. The Battle of Corinth is kind of interesting. It's down here, but it's not on the map. But that's where the Corinthian church comes in. Okay, look at point nine. Herod the Great. You know, remember I told you Herod, he's afraid of the Parthians. He's wanting to keep peace in the land here. So he's Herod. This isn't Herod that killed Jesus. This would be his dad, Herod the Great. The Herod that we know in the New Testament is Herod Antipas. So.
The one who was trying to kill the baby Jesus.
No, well, that's Herod the Great. He died right after that, and then his son is in Matthew, is in the rest of the Gospels. All right. Herod was always trying to make peace with the Jews. So he started this big building program to make the Jews happy. That's where I put in point 10, he rebuilt the temple in Jerusalem. Remember in Haggai and all those guys in Nehemiah, they built the temple, but they were limited. Well, Herod the Great comes in and like kind of, he doesn't rebuild it, but he adds to it. And he like makes the big courtyard. He makes the big retaining walls that hold the courtyard, and those retaining walls are the western wall that, you know, they all stand at today. That's the only thing remaining from this. So Herod the Great was really trying to make the Jews happy, and he did all these cool things, and, you know, public water. He did a lot of stuff, gymnasiums. He became popular with a lot of them. They were called the Herodians. They actually thought Herod might be the Messiah, because he's doing such great things for the Jews. I think that's kind of funny. So Rome rules him for a while, and we kind of know the rest of the story there. Is, you know, when Jesus showed up, Rome was still in control. Herod the Great died. Herod Antipas was on the throne. That kind of ends the 400 years, and that's why back on the first page, they had all those groups, the rabbis, the zealots, the Sadducees. All these groups had developed out of kind of reaction to all the things that was going on around them. They really got caught up in some of them got caught up in the Hellenization, the Greekification. Loved that Greek. So that's kind of what they fought. That's why they're there. You know, I didn't talk about the Mishnah. Think. All right, yeah, look on page six. It was hard to organize this because it all needs to be kind of explained at the same time. On page six, these are those documents that all of a sudden we see now in the New Testament that weren't around in Malachi in the Old Testament. The Midrash, and these are all online, by the way. And like I say, I read these all the time. They're really interesting. I mean, obviously, they're not gospel, but there's just some cool little facts and oral traditions that you can find. The Midrash is just a big commentary of the Old Testament. These are all evolving too. Rabbis are all the time adding to it. Now the Mishnah, that's that oral law that I mentioned. The Jews teach that, you know, Moses was given God gave him a whole set of oral instructions that were never written down until this time period here, and they call it the Mishnah. And the Pharisees put more importance on the Mishnah than the Old Testament writing. So it's kind of crazy. And it's funny, too, because now today, I watch a lot of Jewish lectures. The Pharisees are considered the heroes in the Jewish faith today. Those guys were the defenders of the faith. They stood up against Greece and Rome. They stood up against all this heresy that would come into Israel.
But isn't that where Jesus would come in and go accuse them? Because they asked him why he was not washing before they ate and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he comes in and says that...
Yep.
What was that?
Vessel.
Yeah, he takes them to task all the time. And the way the Jews explain that, they say it's like fighting within a family. Jesus was also a Pharisee, and they were having disagreements over interpretation. So when it seems like Jesus is getting on their case, it really it's not. It's like sitting around a family table arguing with your brother. That's the way they frame it. It's like, wow, okay.
They believe he's a prophet, Messiah.
They don't think he's a Messiah.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that next week. So, the Mishnah, the Talmud, these are just commentaries. Now, the Apocrypha, you know, I mentioned that last week. The Apocrypha here. This is a really interesting book as a history book. This showed up, the authors are unknown, but it showed up during that 400 silent years. It was written in Greek. Don't know who wrote it. But there's actually 1st and 2nd Maccabees in there that really go through a lot of detail, if it's true, on what happened. And they talk all about Judah Maccabee hiding out in the woods. There's some stuff about Daniel in there and Esther. And it's an interesting read. It's just a history thing to keep in context. All right, so page 7. I need to wrap up here. I just put Get Your Greek On. These are a lot of things that we don't realize came from Greece. This is what Israel had to go up against. You know, democracy, our alphabet, the whole library system. We've heard of the big library in Alexandria, down in Egypt. The Greeks required any, it's on a seaport down here. The Greeks required any ship that stopped in Alexandria that all your books have to be copied and stuck in our library. So they were fanatics about that. The Olympics, the Jews loved the Olympics. They had their own stadium. The Greeks did everything naked, wrestling and stuff, because the human body is beautiful, which posed a problem to our Jewish friends because most of them had been circumcised. So they actually came up with a way to reverse circumcision so they could participate in the Olympics. Yeah, it's a bad deal. You gotta love your sports. And architecture, mythology, I mean, we all know mythology. Even Amazon is from, almost everything in our life today can be traced back to Greece. It's really pretty wild. Just wrote some things down. Interesting. Now, on the back page, what's this all mean for us? All right, now I tried to just tie it together. When the Jews were in Malachi, God had given them everything they needed to be successful and to worship Him and to follow Him. They had a complete Bible. They had a structure to worship. They had everything they needed. Well, they got sidetracked with all the shiny objects of Greece and all the cool kids coming into town and went off the rails. Came up with their own religious system somewhat. And because of that, they weren't ready for Him when He came. When the Messiah did come, and John the Baptist, the Messiah is here, these guys were so far off the rails that, you know, as you know, you've heard, you know, that they didn't recognize who He was. They didn't even have a Bible anymore to compare what He's saying to. So... like the especially the Sadducees, they didn't believe all that. But anyway, so, you know, just like us today, we've got to be anxiously awaiting His coming. We got to be looking for Him. We got to be busy doing what the Father wants us to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very simple application there. But it's kind of a weird thing with the 400 years. It's hard to tie it too much in, but that's kind of what I come up with. So, any questions? It's a very, you know, these 400 years were probably the most exciting years of Israel. Man, so much went on. You would not believe how much I had to leave out of my timeline. It was really stressful on me because there was so much cool stuff I wanted to put that I just had to leave out. So, anyway, so next week we'll start in Matthew. right after John the Baptist, or right at John the Baptist, and we'll see how Jesus goes up against all this Greekification stuff. So, let me wrap up here.
Yep. That was so good. I think all of us have maybe bits and pieces, or we've heard some of these, but to put it all together,
like a timeline.
Really did that, Jim. So thank you so much. I look at this as a little bit like the Proverbs 2, where if you cry after knowledge and you lift up your voice for understanding, if thou seekest her as silver and searchest for her as for hid treasure, then shalt thou understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. And I feel like you've done that, Jim. You're seeking, you're digging, and